KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. Many of us think we first met Steve Carell when he was a correspondent on The Daily Show playing Steve Carell. Many of us think we know him from The Office where he plays Michael Scott. But he's made a big splash in movies this last year alone with three big films, Date Night, Despicable Me, and his newest, Dinner for Schmucks. First of all, Steve, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I have to ask, before we get to Dinner for Schmucks, in Date Night, it seemed like there was one of the rare times you were playing a character who wasn't self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a guy who knew exactly who he was and even had a sense of humor. And that seemed to be sort of spotlighted for me in that great scene where Common asks you to get up and you do the impression, get up.
Right.
It was the first time you were able to show a sense of humor in a character. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, he was just a guy. He was just a suburban dad who... was sort of put in an awkward situation. But that was the crux of the comedy there, as opposed to someone who lacked any sort of insight or self-awareness. But yeah, I mean, it was different. It was probably closer to who I am. I hope it's closer to who I am than some of the other characters I play. But you never know.
But I always find myself thinking, when I think about you, the things that you did, the departures, like the turn in Little Miss Sunshine, where, again, another character who's incredibly way too self-aware.
Well, yeah, he's someone who's just so caught up in his own intellect and his own pursuits that he, I think, loses sight of the people around him. And it takes being thrust together with this kind of makeshift family dynamic to wake him up a little bit to that.
I wonder if it comes out of – if it's just a byproduct of being a part of Second City that you do so well in ensembles. I mean, I tend to think of you as being somebody who's really maybe a catalyst in the ensemble, but somebody who does really well in those kinds of large settings.
I prefer ensembles. I prefer I like to hide behind ensembles. Sometimes people ask me about – a comedic background, and being a comedic actor was never my intention. I just wanted to be an actor, and comedies were the things that I just tended to get hired to do more often. But I never did stand up. I don't think I ever had any sort of muscle for that. So I gravitated to performing with other people. I just felt more comfortable there.
Because even though people think they know you, I mean, because you play characters who say their names more often than any other actor I can think of.
Say the characters say their own names?
They say them quite a bit. And I hadn't thought about it until preparing for this. I was like, oh, my God, these guys always say who they are. As if they're like giving a verbal business, a vocal business card or something.
It's sort of off that subject, but my dad loved The Office because they always showed the character – and then had our name underneath. And for some reason, that he just loved the fact that you could see my face and my name at the same time. It wasn't my character's name, but he just thought that was so great for some reason. I don't know what made me think of that.
You often play guys who are announcing themselves to people. And that's an interesting kind of thing to do in a group dynamic, because that makes other people go, why? Yeah, we know who you are. What are you doing?
Yeah, shut up. Fine. Sit down. We know.
But
we got you.
That even starts for a lot of us knowing you from The Daily Show, where, you were playing this guy and just, again, always sort of like letting us know that Steve Carell was there on camera.
That was sort of an arch version of myself. I watched the genesis of Stephen Colbert's character that he plays on The Colbert Report, that we had to early on decide who our characters would be on that show. And Steve and I talked about it. Like, well, are we going to be, the pompous guys? Are we going to be what sort of backstory? And this is just sort of a game that Steven and I played. And I decided that my backstory was, for The Daily Show, was a failed network anchor who had been relegated to going back to the small cable show and then doing kind of bad lifestyle field reporting, and had a real chip on his shoulder about it, and thought that he was better than the type of material he'd been given. And so that was sort of underpinning what I was trying to do.
It's the treat. I'm talking to Steve Carell, whose new film, by the way, is Dinner for Schmucks. We'll get to that presently. But it was just fascinating this last year. I mean, these guys, and again, it's so interesting to see how different your body language is. You're playing a guy who knows himself. I mean, watching Little Miss Sunshine again and then seeing Date Night. And you sort of sit back when you're playing these characters who have a sense of themselves mm-hmm. as compared to these guys who walk into a room and kind of oblivious to everything, who the posture is different even. I mean, in Dinner for Schmucks, he's almost leaning forward. And I think about that to some extent in The Office, too, the way you play Michael Scott. He's, you know, he wants to be – these are guys who want to be seen.
Right.
And I wonder for you if there's kind of a conscious thing.
It's not a conscious thing. I mean, it's not something that I sit at home and think, well, what's the posture going to be or what – I mean, certain things you do think about. For Dinner for Schmucks, I thought about the character look and maybe a little bit about how the character moves. And then kind of once you establish that, other things fall into place. I decided that character was left-handed. I'm naturally right-handed, but I figured I'm just going to favor my left hand for this part and just to see what sort of things that activates in my brain because it's using a different part of my brain. And I just thought that might help inform something about the character or how he moves or what he does. But it's, you know, it's throwing stuff against a wall. You never really know what's going to work or what might help.
Really? You don't?
Not really. I mean, you just try things and you try to not be too hard on yourself if it does or doesn't work.
Was that something you learned to not be so hard on yourself?
I think so. Yeah. I don't think you can be too – either way. You can't be too self-congratulatory if something does work or too tough on yourself if it doesn't.
That's a fascinating thing because I just wondered when you were doing stuff in Chicago, when you in Second City, where it's a really tough room because Chicago crowds are really demanding mm-hmm. and incredibly vocal about what they do and don't like.
Right.
And that sort of got you out of your head and thinking about if you were good or bad because you just had to make the pieces work.
You always had the next night to redeem yourself. It teaches you to let go and not be too precious about any one scene or any one moment or any character that you might have tried because you can always try again. And that was the luxury of Chicago and working at Second City is that we had 6 nights a week to perform. And if the show didn't go particularly well one night, you could try something different the second show. And you'd have a new audience to be a barometer for how you were doing. And, you learn through that.
One of the things I'm struck by this group that you came out of, you and Colbert and Amy Sedaris, is it's almost like there was a sea change. You guys brought reality to comedy. It's almost like there was real acting rather than just the kind of performance with quotation marks on it. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you guys were aware of that as you were doing it.
I don't know if we were. It's something I think we all sort of aspired to ground it in some sort of reality, in some sort of plausibility. I always liked comedic actors who didn't wink at the camera, who didn't put quotes around things, because it seemed that once you take yourself out, you're taking the audience out of it too. If a character thinks that they're doing something that's funny, it's immediately less funny than it would have been. If you believe a character in a play or a movie or a TV show, if you believe they're actually going through something and responding to whatever they're going through, it's not only funnier, but it can be more touching and more moving and just richer.
It's the treat room, I guess, of Steve Carell. His new movie is Dinner for Schmucks, but he's also in Date Night, which is now in hotels everywhere, I can tell you, and Despicable Me. And just asking about that reality, I just sort of thought that you were coming at a time where even the kind of sketch comedy playing was being brought to sitcoms, where everything felt too big and too bright. And I just wonder, when you guys were all working together, you just kind of said, let's be real. Let's just make it honest for ourselves.
I think it's just what we gravitated to as opposed to a conscious decision. And,
that sort of post-Saturday Night Live thing mm-hmm. was very much about that kind of proclaiming kind of comedy. And the stuff you've done as an actor is very different from that.
Well, it's different style, too. I mean, I try not to say something is funny or not. It's just my perspective on what's funny. And it's so subjective as to what's funny. And what I try to do might not appeal and certainly doesn't appeal to everybody. But a lot of sitcoms, historically have been very presentational and very joke-driven. But then there are others that are much more based in reality and humanity and the subtleties of life. But they're just different styles. I mean, I don't think one's necessarily better than the other. It's just what you respond to personally.
But you tend to respond to the stuff that's more honest, don't you?
I think so. I mean, I look at somebody like Peter Sellers, who did extremely broad characters, but you never got a sense that he was winking at the camera. You never got a sense that the actor gave any indication that what he was doing was funny. It was always the character struggling to get through a moment, whether he was slipping on a globe that was turning beside him or doing some sort of broad physical comedy or broad character comedy. I think the underlying theme to what he did was that it was based in his own reality, and you could buy into that. You just bought into him as a character, and I think that's a really fine line to walk, but he did it beautifully.
Going back to – I've never had a chance to see you on stage, but going back to The Daily Show and The Office, by staying focused so much, you could create a kind of tension, an abrasion that basically makes for comedy, that sort of sense of staying in character as Steve Carell in The Daily Show and just sort of people just staring at you for so long they had to say something.
It's like you make people come to you.
Well, yes. I
guess that's true. I mean, it's – at least for me, it's never this conscious thing of, well, this is exactly what I'm going to try or
– Really?
Yeah. It doesn't feel to me like a construct. It doesn't feel like if that works, that's great. The other part of it is I'm always a bit reticent about overanalyzing it and kind of deconstructing it because – there's truly no rhyme or reason to it. I can't explain truly what makes me laugh or what doesn't. Something will just hit me and it will make me laugh.
What made you laugh growing up? What was the kind of stuff that you watched as a kid that really hit you?
It ran the gamut. I mean, I used to love to listen to George Carlin and Steve Martin and Bill Cosby albums. I mean, I would study them. I didn't know I was studying them at the time, but when you listen to something repeatedly – You are studying. You're like learning the rhythms of what they're doing, and you're understanding or deciphering just what is funny about them to you.
But you just mentioned three people that, despite Steve Martin sort of deconstructing comedy, he was in it, mm-hmm. and to the storytelling style of Bill Cosby, to that jabbing social satire of George Carlin. They all committed to these things. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about people who basically made these very specific choices, and this clearly meant something to you.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, they were very different stylistically, but they I can't really define it. It was just something that struck me when listening. And Firesign Theater and National Lampoon Radio Hour and and Peter Sellers and people like Alan Arkin and, you know, actors that would commit and that you wouldn't – they just, I don't know, sort of disappear into whatever they were doing.
Because if you're listening to this stuff, you have to commit with them.
And yeah.
It's funny because I think it's something that's missing from comedy now. I mean, can you imagine your kids listening to comedy in that way and disconnecting from other stimuli in the way that you did?
No, I really can't. And it was a big part of – my growing up. I remember I didn't have a turntable in my room, so I used to go into my brother's room who had a turntable. I would listen to these things over and over and over and sort of imagine them. And Steve Martin, as you said, he really turned comedy upside down. His was sort of an anti-comedy. It was so smart and so silly at the same time.
And a break from tradition, clearly.
It was, completely. He really did deconstruct it. And I thought it was fantastic because there weren't really any jokes. They were premises in a way, and some were just non sequiturs. It seemed so playful, but yet so smart at the same time.
It's a treatment. We'll take a break. My guest is Steve Carell. We got to get him a turntable. His new movie is Dinner for Schmucks. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. Steve Carell has done a ton of things in the last year alone between The Office and Date Night. Despicable Me, which is still making money. Lots of money.
Yeah.
So you got a new watch out of it. And, of course, his newest movie is Dinner for Schmucks. But the one thing I think that did for all you guys, and that's the thing of that generation of being is Paul Rudd and you and Colbert and Amy Sedaris, it made you very specific about word choices. Because all the people we're talking about, language was key for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your characters, the way they talk is very specific to them.
Yeah. When you start talking about language, it also made me think of Tina Fey. She's someone who is so good, and something I learned from her on Date Night. She's incredibly gifted in terms of her language choices and in terms of her wording of a particular line that, by all intents and purposes, shouldn't be funny. But just by the way it's worded and just by the way the wording creates a rhythm and a pattern in your head, it just sounds funny. And it might not even be a joke necessarily, but the way she can phrase things make them funnier.
To me, that's so fascinating about The Office and makes the American version so different is that because it's a bigger country, people can come from all kinds of places, and the way that language flows and sort of butts up against each other, if mm-hmm. I can mix a metaphor here, it makes the American Office distinct from the British version.
It's quite different, and we were really up against it when we started.
Sure.
7 years ago. No one gave our show a chance or didn't think it stood a chance. And I have to say, Ricky Gervais, who created the BBC version, has always been incredibly kind and supportive of our show and wanted our show to be different and wanted it to be whatever it needed to be to find an audience. So he had no pretense about what it should be or whether it should sort of hold the exact same tone as the BBC version.
Which must have been incredibly liberating to you guys.
It was. You know, the first episode was, I think, a line-by-line copy of their first episode. But after that, we were not held to any script of the BBC version. I think NBC specifically wanted us to base our first one on their first one, which we did.
Why was that?
I don't know. I think it was fear in part. I think by using that as a template, they felt like they at least had something strong to begin with. It was a very strong script. But it was easier once our writers got to stretch their legs a little bit and try out their own voices. And that's when the show started to find its own footing.
I think for me it was about the sixth or seventh episode when I realized there were so many more different kinds of people in the American Office mm-hmm. rather than the British version, which they are more or less the same person, basically people who cringed at Ricky Gervais.
You know what? It's funny. I can't really speak to the British version because I still haven't watched it. I am waiting until I'm done with my run to watch Ricky's version.
So this is why you're leaving, so you can finally get around to watching?
Finally. They've been on my shelf collecting dust. Very excited. Just for a reference point, before I auditioned, I watched about 3.5 minutes of the BBC version just to get a sense of the tone. And it was so great, and he was fantastic in it. Just all of the little ticks and just the minute details that he incorporated into his character, I thought, if I watch even a second more, I'll be sunk because I'll just be doing an impression of him once I go in there to audition. So I put it aside and said, if I get it, I'll watch it at the end of our run, which I intend to do.
When we talk about language, I can't help but think about Brick and Anchorman and about how he always had the wrong thing to say at the ready.
Right.
And how difficult that must have been to do.
Talk about liberating. That was the most fun I've ever had doing anything because I didn't need to do anything but try not to laugh at Will Ferrell. It was just so much fun. And Adam McKay, who directed the movie, I didn't have many lines in the movie. And Adam would, from time to time, come up to me and say, at the end of the scene, just say something. And that was those were my marching orders. And so I'd just say something stupid, like I ate a red candle or I love lamp, you know.
It's The Treatment. It's Steve Carell talking about things he loves. His new movie, by the way, is Dinner for Schmucks. When Jay Roach was here, I just said, this movie, and if you look at all of his movies, you can see the influence of The Party. And I just wonder, for somebody like that who has a body of work, how you prepare to make films with them, because you made films with people who don't have that longer body of work.
Right.
And what was like in this case?
Well, I just felt like I would be in good hands. Here's somebody who really knew what he was doing. And he also has such a gentle way about him that he can invariably make you feel like you had the best idea when it was frankly his idea to begin with. But the way he gives notes and the way he builds you up and makes you feel about how you're shooting, he sort of gives you ownership of it. And then you look back and think, oh, no, that was really his – that was his idea. He's very stealthy that way.
Is that what a real director feels like to you, somebody who gets his ideas across without you feeling you being assaulted by them?
That was his way of doing it. And I don't know if it's a conscious choice on his part. It's just a very gentle way of creating that he has.
Well, speaking of somebody who's had a long body of work, your first film you made was somebody who had a long body of work behind him, John Hughes.
Yeah.
I was on Curly Sue. What was that like?
Well, I was a young actor in Chicago, and not many movies came through Chicago. So even to get an audition for a movie was a big feather in your cap. And I got an audition, and it was for a tiny, tiny part. It was the assistant to the – it was like the second waiter, and I think his name was Tessio. I had no lines, and it was a movie starring Jim Belushi, and I remember I just could not have been more nervous. My bit was Jim Belushi enters, and the maitre d' snaps his fingers and says, Tessio, and I'm basically come up to throw Jim Belushi out of the restaurant because he looks like a hobo. And so I just looked Jim Belushi up and down. So that was my bit. And I shot for 3 days, and I could not have been – 3 days of shooting
3 days.
For that. And then it was such a resounding success for me, I didn't do another movie for 12 years.
For John, so he didn't direct many after that. For a while.
I think that might have been his last movie. I think that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you had a feeling of going in, what it was like to sit – and just talk to him, because you have to do that with the director to get the part.
I was very shy. As I remember, I went in, read the part, thanked him, and left. I could not have been more petrified. So I thought the shorter amount of time I spend in here, the better off I'll be.
Don't do that here. It's The Treatment. My guest is Steve Carell. His newest film as actor is Jennifer Schmuckle. You talked about somebody who, for everybody in Second City, must have been like a model of the way you want to lead your career that you got to work with, and that's Alan Arkin.
Yes. I'm a huge Alan Arkin fan. I remember when I got cast in Little Miss Sunshine, the directors, Dayton and Ferris, said, oh, and for Grandpa, we've cast Alan Arkin. And it was as if, you know, it's when you hear that, it's like one of your idols, you know, somebody that you've looked up to and respected and never thought you would meet, let alone get to work with. And it's great when somebody like that lives up to all of your expectations of who they'd be. He was so much fun and just so funny and such a fantastic actor. And I remember we did some rehearsal. We did a week or two of rehearsing before we started to shoot. And we all went out in a van, and the director sat at the back of the van quietly and just videotaped. It was a field trip, and we all went in character. And so we all sat in our positions, and Alan Arkin sat at the back. And everyone was trying very hard to improvise and come up with things and speak in their character voices and explore. Nothing from Alan Arkin. He just silent at the back of the van. And I thought, wow, is he not into this? What's going on? And a half an hour went by. We're driving around, 45 minutes. Finally, from the back of the van, we start hearing, oh, I gotta go pee. And it wasn't Alan Arkin. It was his character, his grandpa, improvising that we had to pull over so he could pee. And I mean, trying desperately, even though it was just a rehearsal, trying desperately not to break character, because it was the funniest and just most subtle thing. And it started so small and so gently. And he's a real master at understatement and kind of throwing things away and not putting a lot of weight on a certain line or a certain moment. I just marvel at him. And, you know, we've become friends.
And you got to work with him again on Get Smart.
On Get Smart, yeah.
Do you feel like at a certain point, though, because it seems like in the last couple of years especially, you've done so many different things and you're leaving the office, there's a hunger in you now just to maybe try to find new challenges for yourself.
This has been a pretty busy year. It's sort of by chance the way it happened that all of these things lined up in such a short period of time, because Despicable Me is something I'd been working on for 3 years, and that just happened to be released now. So there were a lot of things that just aligned at once. So it probably seems like I've been busier than I've actually been.
And I take it back, because clearly, you need to leave a TV show where you're working all the time because you don't want to. No.
I'm a slacker.
I got that from you. I'm sorry. The glint from your airport watch is killing me here as you talk about being a slacker. But you're talking about specific kinds of choices. And I must have the idea of somebody like Zach Galifianakis, who I think is his generation's version of Steve Martin, that he has a very specific style of comedy that comments on comedy as he's doing it. Just watching you two guys work together, how do you guys prepare? And how do you also keep from breaking up and working with him?
He was incredibly hard not to break up with. His mind just works differently than most people. The connections he makes and just sort of how his brain fires is so unique and so surprising that it's hard not to respond. It's hard not to laugh. And every take would be different. And I think the thing that I discovered about him is that Zach is a really good actor. He would come in.
And he commits in that way we're talking
completely
about.
Completely committed. He would come in character. And there's one scene he enters the big final dinner sequence and he makes a grand entrance. And I watched him make this entrance and it wasn't just an entrance. I could see him in character assessing the situation and sort of gauging where he fit in to this. From the minute he walked in the door, he was in character and really committed to it.
But also in that we were talking about these other comedians that you grew up listening to, he's very stylized in the way he thinks as a comic as well. So it's unusual that somebody like that is also an actor, because it's hard, I think, to divorce oneself from that kind of skill set.
Yeah, because you're letting go of one thing to embrace another. And if he carried that through, he would be doing that thing of winking at the camera and sort of deconstructing acting or deconstructing character acting. And I don't think you can really do that to any great effect. He just, I think, just moves from one thing to the other and embraces the acting part of it as something separate. But he still brings that brain. He still brings, when he improvises, he's improvising within character. He's improvising on story. He's not doing superfluous things. He's adding to whatever's going on in the scene. And the same could be said for Paul and Jemaine Clement and Lucy Punch. These are all and David Walliams. These are all people, really great actors and great improvisers, in the sense that they're all improvising within their own characters, and they're not just saying things in order to be funny.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
My guest is Steve Carell. One of his many new movies is Dinner for Schmucks. Our recording engineer, NPR New York, is Neil Rauch. Our editor is Bob Carlson. If you have questions about the show, go to kcrw.com/thetreatment. Gemma Dempsey, the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.